Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here with us on the Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. Across from me this morning, I have Jordy Yeager. He's a journalist, a freelance journalist raised here in Charlottesville, earned his master's in journalism from Boston University. For 6 years, he covered Congress and the federal government in Washington, D.C., but since 2013, Jordy's focused on issues of equity and racial disparities in his own hometown. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Today, we're going to start a conversation on this gigantic fabulous article you can find in SeavilleTomorrow.org on the reimagining of friendship court. Humongous piece of work. How long did it take you to write this?
We'd probably been working on it since the summer of 2018, so probably about 4 or 5 months in total. And
And I say write it, yeah, but that's really not all that it is.
It was
create.
Exactly. Exactly. Writing is definitely part of it. I think it ended up being about 17,000 words in total. But as you say, there are many other kind of visual and audible components to it. And so that really took a good deal of time as well. I ended up cutting about 350 audio clips for the whole thing. So this is a series of 24, 25 long form interviews that we did with folks. And we wanted to be able to give that to people to listen to in its entirety without having to sit through a 45-minute or an hour-long interview. So we would chop up probably minute and a half to three-minute segments of each interview, responses to questions in their entirety so that people could hear it. And then we also, another component was documents and maps and the research materials that had really fleshed this piece out and brought it to life for me. I wanted people to have access to in a firsthand sort of way as well. So often those things kind of remain buried. And so writing was definitely part of it, but then how do you get all of those materials and formats to bring to people was another whole nut to crack.
Well, first of all, let me say that I love having you on the program because you do great work. One of my favorite first interviews with you was this incredible piece that you did on sort of the panhandlers in the area, and I'll always remember that. But for many people here, the reimagining of friendship court, I would think that for some listeners, they're like, friendship court. What is that? Where is that? Why is that worth listening to for the remainder of the hour? So give us 3-4 sentences as to what's going to play out.
Sure, absolutely. So Friendship Court is a neighborhood south of downtown. It's about 2 blocks from the downtown mall. It is the largest concentration of Section 8 housing in the downtown area. And so Section 8 is a subsidy issued by the federal government that allows people with incomes below the poverty level to have affordable rents. This is a neighborhood that was created in 1978 after urban renewal bulldozed a majority, probably 90% black neighborhood in South Downtown. And so this is a kind of follows on the lengthy history of racist housing policies in Charlottesville that mirrored much of the country as well. And so today it's known as Friendship Court, but in 2003, for about 15 years prior, it had been known as Garrett Square. About 20 years prior. It had been known as Garrett Square. And it's situated on Garrett Street to the north and Monticello Ave to the south and 6th Street to the east and 2nd Street to the west. It's a two square block radius. It's about 12 acres, I believe, a little shy of 12 acres. And as I said, there are 150 homes there. and they are about 40 years old and in need of either some serious rehabilitation. Paint is peeling off, tiles are coming up off the floor, pipes are clogging, or as residents and the nonprofit that owns it, Piedmont Housing Alliance, has proposed the redevelopment of it. And so that's going to mean building entirely new 150 Section 8 apartments or townhomes, and then adding another 300 units to that property. So right now we have a piece of it, a large piece of it, that's just green space. And some of that is contains a basketball court. Another part of that contains a garden that community members use and tend to, and that will all be used for housing. And so that's initially where that first phase of housing will go. And so we're talking about breaking ground in 2020. And this is going to be the first major downtown development of this kind that Charlottesville's seen in probably close to 40 years. And so it's really significant, especially as the city and the region as a whole confront the housing crisis that is really plaguing people who do not make above $60,000, $70,000. And even those that do, it's affecting them, of course, too. But
so you can see this entire piece produced and put together, written by Jordy on SeevilleTomorrow.org. Go to just like it sounds, SeevilleTomorrow.org, and it'll pop up. You can look for it, Friendship Court, because it's, I don't want to scare you away, but it's a massive piece of work with so many audible clips and photos and images. But it's worth looking at. Please do. But Jordy and I are going to talk about bits and pieces of it throughout the hour. I've got some questions. So keep listening in. Jordy, one of the first pieces early in the article includes this quote from the will of Alexander Garrett, and I'd like to know why that's so early in the piece.
Sure. So Alexander Garrett is the namesake for which Garrett Street is named. And I don't think very many people, myself including, before I started this process, really knew that. And Alexander Garrett was the first bursar or kind of financial officer for the University of Virginia. He was a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson. He's actually buried in the Jefferson family graveyard up at Monticello. He was also the clerk of the court here in Albemarle County. So he had a very kind of civically prominent position. He also enslaved and was able to do all those things because he enslaved upwards of 50 individuals, 50 people. And those men and women and children have never really publicly been named, but there they are in his will book. There are probably many more, but those are the ones that were alive that he was enslaving at the time of his death, and he bequeathed them to his children in his last will and testament. And I think that that's really imperative to when we're talking about a history of a place. I think so often we try to compartmentalize different periods, different eras. But when you start looking at it as a continuum, then it begins to take on a different hue, and things that you didn't see before start to come to light. And so one of the things with that area was that it was Alexander Garrett's plantation. So it was about 110 acres, 112 acres that stretched south of what we now consider downtown. And all of that was his plantation that he called Oak Hill. And his house, his plantation house, was actually in the vicinity of where Friendship Court is today. It was called Midway. And of course, the first white school for elementary school students in Charlottesville was called Midway Elementary, situated very close to there at the intersection of what's now Ridge and Main Street. And of course, now Midway Manor sits there. So these names continue on, but I don't think that very many of us, myself included, again, really knew where they originated or the genesis of them. And I think that that carries some significance and some power behind it to really understand how we got to where we are today.
The quote that you put up there is, "I hereby give unto my son John E. Garrett and to his heirs forever my Negro man Montgomery."
Right, right, right. And one thing I didn't include in the article, but that should bear some note, is that you know, there's a record, there's an oral history at the very least of the Jefferson family. I believe it's Jefferson's son. It could be his cousin. I don't have the details in front of me, but the Jefferson family selling a descendant of the Hemings family. So I believe it was the daughter of Critta Hemings and her granddaughter to Alexander Garrett. And he then enslaved them. The youngest ran away and was subsequently sold on the auction block just four blocks north of there in Court Square in downtown Charlottesville. And so, you know, these histories have affected many, many lives. The descendants of that granddaughter who was auctioned there still live in Charlottesville today. This is not something that was far, far ago, and she'll have no more ramifications. I think that they continue to have legacies and effects that we need to consider.
And there's, I didn't do the count and keep it in my notes, but there's a double-digit number of slaves in the Garrett family. So I'm assuming that there are numerous family members that are still in the area.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in his will, he names, I think, 51 individuals. And so, of course, yeah, they would have family. A lot of people move, of course. And so, you know, it may be not as many as we might think, but certainly there are descendants in this area.
Because we'll come back to it later in the hour, but another piece of work, article that you did for NPR where we talk about family members coming back to Highlands, some slave families, descendants come back. So these things, whether they took place in the 1700s or the 1800s, they still work into current events of today.
Right. And I think one of those, you know, when we're talking about that connection between the past and today, I think one of those legacies that we need to consider, in particular when it comes to housing, is how much autonomy you have over your circumstance, right? That slavery was the epitome of stripping away decision-making capacity from individuals, that they were forced into every circumstance imaginable and unimaginable in life, and that we as a country have professed our desire to move away from that gradually through a different series of policies and actions, and that if we truly are about reestablishing or maybe establishing for the first time the reality of autonomy for individuals, of your ability to make a decision that affects your life and your outcome, then we need to take into consideration where these policies originated and how, in order to undo them, in order to reconsider how we need to make decisions today that might be more equitable.
Again, our guest today on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call is Jordy Yeager. He's a local journalist. His current piece that we're discussing, The Reimagining of Friendship Court, can be found on sevilletomorrow.org. Jordy, one of the quotes I found in your article is, quote, "The plan alone is groundbreaking." What makes you say that?
It's just a massively complex plan, first and foremost. And so from a planning perspective, it's really, really complicated. And we can go into some of those details. But I think really what I was referring to with that is how it was developed. And so traditionally, plans for housing sites or subdivisions or developments, they are top-bottom by design. So in other words, architects, designers, planners are the ones making the decisions about how wide the street should be, about how many bedrooms each unit or home should get, about whether there are trees, whether there's playgrounds, where the streets connect to the remaining outside perimeter of the city or the area. All of these decisions get made traditionally by those who are paid six figures and up and go to college or go to a graduate program to really study these issues. And for the first time in Charlottesville on this scale, What Piedmont Housing Alliance has done over the last 3 years is engage residents in that process. And so they first hired a community organizer to be on site at in the neighborhood, who then facilitated an election process by which residents elected other residents in their community, in their neighborhood, to serve on an advisory panel. And that advisory panel would then act as liaisons for the next several years between the other 450 residents in the neighborhood and these designers, these planners, these architects, and the heads of the nonprofit Piedmont Housing Alliance. And that really had not been done on this scale. It had been done on similar scales, I think, in Habitat for Humanity projects. But again, that's home ownership. This is a rental situation, which is a little bit different because renters, by and large, do not get a whole lot of say as to the details of where they rent, of the makeup of their homes. And so from that angle, it really was a groundbreaking process and attempt at rethinking how development gets conducted here.
I'm curious as to, so we talked about Alexander Garrett and his early ownership of the land. But once it leaves his hands, what happens to it next?
Sure. So it passes on to his children, and then through a series of transfers, it ends up being subdivided early in the 20th century. It doesn't get subdivided into one giant neighborhood. It gets subdivided into many different parcels. And so single-family homes are constructed throughout.
Is it sold? I mean, do the Garrett family, do the Garrett children sell it? Or are they still owning it?
No. Yes, they do. They sell it and or give it and bequeath it. You know, kind of almost a barter sort of thing. There are some instances where land was given in exchange for other things, other land traded, in other words. But by and large, it leaves their hands. Absolutely. And then single families, development companies, businesses buy up a lot of that property. And so the north side of that area runs alongside the train tracks and the rail line. And when the rail line came through Charlottesville, that was the focal point of all industry, of not only commerce coming in and out, but also of working class jobs. And so naturally, the homes that started popping up and being built in that area they belonged to working class families and or landlords who rented to working class families. And all in all, there ended up over the course of probably from the early 20th century up until 1975, 1976, there ended up being 184 structures being built just in that about 4 or 5 square block radius south of downtown, and largely working class. Of course, today that's shifted quite dramatically, but at that time it was working class, and there are a lot of stories of people remember growing up here. It wasn't that far ago that this was the reality down there.
Tell me a story.
Well, so one of the people I interviewed for this project was Mary Carey, and she is 72 years old and grew up in this area. In fact, her uncle lived across the street from probably one of the more infamous things in Charlottesville's history, which is the brothel, Miss Marguerite's house. And she ran a brothel, and that was frequented by almost entirely all white clientele, both from Charlottesville and outside, and of course the University of Virginia students, professors, and that's probably the most infamous and salacious detail. But beyond that, her uncle worked for what became Elliott's Ice Company, so it's a Charlottesville Ice Company. In pictures, you can see these giant smokestacks downtown, and they belong to the ice company that was right along the railroad line. And he every Sunday would get a free pint of ice cream from his employer, and he would walk with Mary, or he would send Mary and her sisters down to the ice company, and she would get to pick out the flavor of the pint. Of course, she had to share it with everybody; she couldn't have it all to herself. These sorts of things. Mary also remembers in 1944, the neighborhood grocer opened, and by the time she was a child, she was going there pretty regularly. You know, it was the neighborhood staple for meats, for produce, for canned goods, for anything that you might need. It was called Allen's Store, and it was owned by a family that lived about a half block down the street. Dorothy and Kenneth Allen. And of course, they had to move once urban renewal came through, and they were forced to move by the city government at that time. But these things are our childhood memories. Mary also remembers delivering papers in that neighborhood. She remembers being called racist slurs by white people in that neighborhood. And of course, she was one of the first families to move into Friendship Court in the 70s. So she didn't move very far.
Jordy Yeager with us today as we talk about his article, The Reimagining of Friendship Court. Hang tight. Lots more to talk about. Be right back. And back with Jordy Yeager and Rick Moore to discuss the reimagining of Friendship Court. Jordy, you were talking about Alan's store and Margarita's house.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pieces, the article, some of the, you've got so many things here on the article at SeavilleTomorrow.org where you can find the article. There was a newspaper clipping about how when Margarita's house was torn down, that people went down there looking for money that might have been fallen out from between the walls.
That's right. That's right. Well, there was so much money exchanged in that house that, you know, this was part lore and part myth, but also part reality. And that was that there's – well, so one of the stories is that when the house was torn down, a giant wrecking ball was brought in, you know, kind of like you can imagine in the movies. And this big steel wrecking ball smashes through this old brick house. And as it does, you know, dust and debris go everywhere. But wads and piles of money just starts floating through the air. And
that's because
it was stuffed into the wall.
The staff, to hide it from any police who might come through at an unknown time, would stuff it in hidden nooks and crannies?
Exactly. That there was no bank worth trusting with that much money, and so the best, safest place was in the walls. You know, similar to how maybe people hide money in the basement or in their mattresses. And sure enough, once all of the building was razed and demolished, people would set out plots in the middle of the late afternoon once they got off of work, kind of like an archaeological dig. And they would set up their little flags with their name or their initials on it, and they would come out with their shovel or rake or whatever they had and just start digging. And you know, Mary Carey tells a story of a family member indeed finding a big jar of coins and money. You know, she also says that the wrecking ball crew, once they saw that plume of money wafting through the air, they stopped what they were doing and they gathered everything they could, and they weren't seen again. They left town with all of that money. Now, how much of this is lore and how much of it is myth? You know, I don't know. And hearsay, I think there are some newspaper accounts that kind of corroborate some of it. There's some pictures, but it definitely makes for a good story regardless.
One of the pieces in the, I guess it's the Daily Progress, talks about how several weeks after all this happened that there were some deposits of old dirty bills. I love that.
In banks, yeah.
Yeah, in banks. But then a little bit more about the Allen's store. This store seems to have been quite successful and quite, I mean, this was the place to go, and yet urban renewal forced it to close?
Right, right.
So I want this to take us into, what is urban renewal for? Why was this happening?
Sure. So where to begin? The housing policies and the planning policies of the 50s and the 60s were largely conducted by white governments throughout the country. And I make that distinction of race because they impacted African American neighborhoods, businesses, and families in a really, really horrendous way, in so much as it took away any sort of sense of community. It stripped them of neighborhood economic possibilities. Just to give an example, in about four blocks to the east, to the west of Garrett Street area was Vinegar Hill. Vinegar Hill was the largest economic center and hub of African-American life in Charlottesville at that time. And I say economic center because there are at least 29 black-owned businesses there. And we're talking everything from restaurants and barbershops to seamstresses and tailors to haberdasheries and shoe cobblers. There's saloons. This was everything that you would want in a city. You had access to, and because of our Jim Crow era separate segregation policies, black people had to have theirs, and white people had to have theirs. And so, very few of these economic opportunities were open to black and white families. And then, of course, you have the decision of Brown versus Board, which opened the gates to integration or desegregation. And that was in 1954. And just prior to that, you had the formation for the first time in Charlottesville of the Housing Authority. And this was on a narrow vote. I think it was 33 votes.
36
votes. According to your, there it is. Yeah.
I wrote that down. Close votes in 1954, 36 votes.
Yeah. And this was a really contentious, so that indicates that it was a contentious vote, that this was not something that overwhelmingly people in Charlottesville approved of. And of course, during that time, there was a poll tax. And so this is only recording the votes of people who could afford to buy that vote. And of course, race and economics have been intertwined since the foundation of this country. And so you can get a sense for who that vote was trying to be prejudiced against. And so what urban renewal did was it used the justification of quote unquote, I'm using quotation marks, of blight or slum as code words for undesirable to white officials, undesirable landscapes. And so they could use anything from the quality of a building material to the lack of indoor plumbing to lack of paved streets to increased likelihood of disease or illness. All of these were used as justifications, and instead of trying to remediate or give access to resources or opportunities within this and break down these structural barriers that were imposed between black and white communities, they said, you know what, we're just going to bulldoze it all and start over. And when they do that, they had to appraise the value of these homes and these businesses and the properties, because all of this finds its root within the Fifth Amendment. And the last clause of the Fifth Amendment says that the government may confiscate, may obtain the property of an individual with just compensation as long as it's for public use. Now, there's a lot of contentiousness about what public use actually entails, right? But this is not the last time, definitely not the first time, that Charlottesville city government has used eminent domain and this ability to confiscate property under public use for the white city government to use. So in any case, in order to make the justification for raising properties, they have to declare a property slummed or blighted. And once that's done, they then are able to offer that owner a fair market value, what they deem a fair market value. But they don't offer that owner a decision, a choice. They do not have a choice. They can go through a condemnation process if they refuse to sell, or they can take the money and move. But there's no chance of them remaining or staying in that area. And so that's what urban renewal did in Charlottesville. And Vinegar Hill is probably perhaps the most well-known instance of that. But this area of Garrett Street had, as I said, 184 structures, Allen Store being one of those businesses that operated in that neighborhood, that many people have known and loved for generations. And that this was not, part of the history that we as people growing up in Charlottesville are often taught. And it has a significant bearing on how policies are conducted today for a lot of individuals who do remember this, who live through it, and or whose parents live through it. But for policymakers and decision makers of today who perhaps didn't grow up here and or didn't learn about this, they operate with an ignorance about this historical landscape that I think is to their detriment.
When we talk about the close vote of the Public Housing Authority at 36, well, the the vote differential for Vinegar Hill was only 23.
Right. Yeah, it was not a sweeping approval.
Well, so to get back to the reimagining of Friendship Court, the bulldozers move in 1973 for the
184
homes that were already there.
Oh, yeah. And then over the next 4 or 5 years, they continue to bulldoze and raise the property. And then that property then becomes is then owned by the Charlottesville Redevelopment Housing Authority, because that's the entity that the Housing Authority establishes to conduct urban renewal.
And what's the goal?
The goal, as stated by the CRHA, the Charlottesville Redevelopment Housing Authority, is to quote unquote revitalize the neighborhood, and so to bring out new opportunities for homes and for businesses that will be attractive to all residents. Right. This is the coded language that they use at the time. Of course, what they mean by that
it can't just be old homes for black people.
Right. Or even investment opportunities for the city. You know, that infrastructure investment into neighborhoods is a decision that I think often gets overlooked in terms of who gets paved streets, who gets potholes filled, who gets water lines or gas lines as these things are first being constructed. And so the ability to deem a property or an area slummed or blighted is really the fault of the cities, that it hasn't invested any sort of resources or access to infrastructure developments into these neighborhoods. But instead of taking ownership over that or acknowledgement of that, they say, we're going to establish a housing authority. We're going to bulldoze these houses and these businesses. And then we're going to sell that a good sized portion of that property to a private company. And that's what becomes Garrett Square, which now is called Friendship Court.
So if I live in a house in one of those homes in 1972, what happens to me? What happens to me in my home? The bulldozer is going to come in a year. What is going on to me?
Sure. So you're offered a value for your home
which certainly isn't what it's valued to me.
Right, and certainly not what it would be worth today, even with inflation. And so that's another issue, is that it's quite valuable property and land today, which, you know, 40 years ago, that based on the valuation systems, it was not as valuable, but it was still significantly valuable. And so you're offered that price for your home and for your land, and you're told by when you need to move out. And there are several condemnation lawsuits that were filed in Vinegar Hill. I'm still searching through records to see if I can find some for Garrett Street. But essentially, if you refuse, then the housing authority and the city then proceed with what's called a condemnation suit, which is essentially their justification, their assessment of why your home should be condemned and bulldozed, and that it is a danger to the public.
All right, so I'm going to lose.
So you're going to lose. And so then, you know, you can take the money that they offer you, or potentially risk having that money reduced if they find that your home is even worse off than right. initially appraised. And you're forced to move. And so then I think you see a lot of families in Charlottesville move to surrounding neighborhoods. You see some move to the county and try to buy property and build homes there. You see some move to Richmond and D.C. or Atlanta, that they are done with Charlottesville altogether. But you see some stay in the area. You know, I think one of the things that we're working on in Charlottesville from a historical perspective is looking at where families move and how families move. That often there's this idea that the city is a confined area, but there's a very porous border with the surrounding counties, and not just Albemarle, but Fluvanna, Louisa, Buckingham. I mean, these are not isolated sort of areas. That people come and go, and families come and go over generations. And so it's very fluid, and I think that's something that we need to keep in mind as well. But yes, you would be forced to leave. And
was I paid enough to move and start a new, buy a new home?
Yeah, technically, yes.
Now, I don't mean by the government standards. I mean in a real world of 1973 time period, was I paid enough to go buy a new house? Or was I given this 10 cents on the dollar figure where I then had to say, what in the world am I supposed to do with this?
Right. Yes, you could buy a new home. Now, then the question becomes, where could you buy a new home? Right. And so in the majority of Charlottesville, neighborhoods have restricted home ownership to white families. And these are called racially restricted covenants. And they were deemed illegal and unenforceable by the Supreme Court in 48, but then also with the Fair Housing Act in 1968. So by the time this urban renewal process comes along in the early 70s, technically, legally speaking, you do not have any grounds to be discriminated against. But of course, we know that that discrimination still continues to this day.
Do I want to buy there and get that look every day when
exactly.
I have my kids get that look every day?
Or worse, right? Exactly. So, yes, you were paid enough to buy a home, but where could you buy a home? And did you risk going through this process again? You know, this strikes a fear in people that says, we do not care what you say or what you think about what should happen to your neighborhood. And so, realistically, when you're thinking about where to move, that's got to be in the back of your head of, well, where would I move that's going to be safe? Not necessarily just for me, but for my future of children or grandchildren, that you're looking for roots. And that is really the heart of urban renewal that struck into people, is that it disrupted community. It disrupted this place of belonging and of being able to see your values reflected in your neighbors.
Jordy Yeager here with us today. He's a journalist. You can find his latest article/creation, The Reimagining of Friendship Court, is on SeevilleTomorrow.org. Jordy, just a few minutes before our next break. So what is the goal of the city for the image of Garrett Square?
You're talking today?
Then. In 1973, 1974.
Yeah. Well, at that time, there was still this belief within the planning community and within architects and designers and city officials that we could create new communities, intentional
communities.
Because
Section 8 housing didn't exist, did it?
Right. Well, so government subsidies were being established. And you have a variety of different mechanisms at play. You have what's known as public housing, which is established by a housing authority. It's administered federal dollars on a local level. And so that is the creation of brick and mortar structures, actual homes that are subsidized by federal government. And then you have what's the creation of Section 8, which is, federal dollars administered on a local level, but instead of actually being homes that are established with those federal dollars, you have vouchers. So you have what are considered rental subsidies for these units that are actually owned by either a nonprofit in the current case or in historical cases, private companies.
So what was the city's goal in 1974? What was their hope and what did they want Garrett Square to be, was the image?
Oh, it's a tricky question because it really depends on the level of sincerity you believe the city had. So the city professed that it wanted a tight-knit community that was affordable for low-income families in Charlottesville. And it said that Friendship Court, what was Garrett Square at the time, was the answer to it. Now I say it's tricky because if you talk to people who lived through that time period, they would say that's lip service at best. In reality, if they wanted those things, if they wanted a prosperous community for affordable housing and low income families in downtown Charlottesville, they would have done other things as well. They would have tried to eliminate more systemic barriers to access to education and job opportunities, as well as social networks and economics for businesses. But they didn't, and they continued on with this process of concentrating poverty. But then what's really tricky is then in the early 80s, the federal government took away funding for housing authorities writ large throughout the country, and Charlottesville is no exception.
Let's take a break real quick. We'll come back. That's a deep topic that we're getting into, and there's no way we can finish that up before the next break with Jordy Yeager. The Reimagining of Friendship Court. Hang tight. All right, here we are back with Jordy Yeager. His article with audio clips, visual photos, PDFs, I guess is the best way to put it, of old newspaper articles and other pieces can be found on cvilletomorrow.org, The Reimagining of Friendship Court. Jordy is a freelance journalist. You can find other works of his, NPR, Seville Weekly, where else?
Local stuff. I've done some national stuff with The New Yorker, with Columbia Journalism Review, local public radio, WVTF out of Roanoke, or WMRA or WCVE in Richmond.
There you go.
Yeah.
You can find that work everywhere. And the occasional Sunday here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. I feel blessed. But today, currently, we're talking about Friendship Court, which started as Garrett Square. Why did they change the name?
It occurred around 2003, and the desire was to destigmatize the residents who lived there. And so residents, by and large, said and still continue to say to a certain extent today that the outside areas of Charlottesville would stigmatize them as being lesser than. So that if you lived in Garrett Square, that you were not as good or not deserving or in some way inferior to other residents throughout the rest of the city.
Garrett Square does have a sort of a, I don't know the best way to put this, but having lived in Charlottesville since, you know, I went to UVA a number of years ago, it has that stereotype.
Right. Well, and I think it depends on who you are, whether that has that stereotype. So if you live there, you know, that certainly that probably...
I've read enough Daily Progress articles that it has that...
Sure. Yeah.
From never having lived there,
right,
I'll say.
Right. And so if you live there, I think that can become quite tiring to hear, especially when a lot of the issues that were being pointed out in terms of drug addiction and or criminal activity of violence.
They put a fence around it.
They did put a fence around
it. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
Why did they put a fence up?
That was in 96, 97. And again, it was this this misplaced desire, redefine. Well, that was the question.
To keep everybody safe?
That was the question of, does it keep crime out or does it keep us in? And I don't think anybody has really found a concrete answer other than they've settled on it being more constraining than not. And so it feels like it's an attempt to kind of cordon off residents rather than protect them. And if you remember, the fencing was a lot more extensive than what it is today. Even today, gates are locked. You know, some of the fencing has gates and a lot of that is locked during certain hours. You know, when it first went up, families were really concerned about what this meant in terms of access. Like if there was a fire, if a fire truck had to come through, how firefighters don't know the system of gates and where you had to go. It was like a maze. And then also school buses would come on Second Street there. Children that lived 10 feet away from the school bus had to walk all the way down to Monticello and all the way back around. It was just a huge inconvenience. And again, in a lengthy series of slaps in the face, another slap in the face.
It just seemed like, again, as someone who has never lived in Friendship Court or Garrett Square, in whichever decade I might have lived there, the media... Daily Press articles seem to have given it a stereotype, a negative stereotype, and the gate did not help.
No, the gate did not help. And I think in 2003, you know, when they changed the name to Friendship Court, I think it was born out of that desire to try to on a very kind of surface level, change some of that stigmatization.
I think that helped because now I have to go friendship court. Where's that?
Right, right, right. Well, and but again, this is, you know, this points back to our inability as a city to really address issues at their core. And so that, yes, change the name.
Change the name.
That's fine.
But did that fix any of the problems?
Exactly.
The other issues that we're talking about that we need to get into, which is, you know, which is so many of the other things, which is the, well, where can we even start? You know, we can get into the discrimination issue, other modern day inequalities of who gets to vote and who has money to do which parts of life and, mm-hmm. you know,
yep.
But changing the name of where you live, oh, that'll solve all our problems.
Right, right, right. Exactly. And so rather than looking at what is it in us that allows or accepts the stigmatization of our neighbors, we say, you know, this is something that we want to try and solve as easy as possible.
Will they change the name again in 2020?
It's on the table. It's on the table. Nobody's actually, you know, concretely talked about possibilities of what it would be. But I think that that is something residents are debating and considering. You know, it may very well stay the same.
Are there any cons to the reimagining?
Well, there is criticism of it, and that is part of the redevelopment plans right now, again, is to replace all 150 Section 8 units, and so every resident that has a home will have a home continuous for the foreseeable future. And then at the end of the project, they will have added 300 other units to that neighborhood.
Is that all the green space being gone?
It's a mix. So it's broken up into four phases, but phase one is the development of that green space. And one of the things that residents wanted was to not have certain buildings dedicated to certain income levels. And so those added 300 units that are coming into the neighborhood will be at higher or roughly the same income levels, depending. But they will be interspersed and mixed throughout all of the different future buildings. And so you'll have a family that makes $14,000 living next to a family that makes $35,000 living next to somebody that potentially makes $69,000. There's going to be a wide swath. And that is very intentional by residents. Now, of course, there is criticism of that, that mixed income in Charlottesville has not always worked in terms of intentional mixed income communities, that this is grounds for some displacement by other means, by social or psychological or even cultural means. And so whether it will work, it remains to be seen, of course, but it is a very concentrated and well thought out attempt at intentional mixed income housing.
That's something I wrote in my notes. I don't know if this was your question or you quoting someone else. Asked, does mixed income housing work? And my question is, why wouldn't it? So I guess we're into the psychological, sociological feedback on that.
Right. There are a number of different reasons why it doesn't work.
Or hasn't.
Or hasn't worked. I mean, one of the ones that our mayor, Nakai Walker, talks about is different kind of standards of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in one's life. And so when you're talking about more affluent, and in Charlottesville, by and large, that means white families who have a certain way of speaking to their children or interacting with their children. They may be more likely to call Child Protective Services or some sort of outside agency like the police to intervene into a neighborhood affair because they don't want to deal with it firsthand and or maybe they can't deal with it firsthand, and so they call an outside agency. And what Mayor Walker points to is that these organizations, these agencies, Child Protective Services, Foster Care Department of Social Services, the Charlottesville Police Department, they have histories of disproportionately affecting African Americans in a very negative way in terms of separating families, in terms of incarcerating men and women, in terms of really of just discriminating against African Americans in ways that white families do not experience, and so as a result feel very comfortable calling and interacting with. And so that's just one small example of where a wealthy and a less wealthy family may be living side by side, and instead of resolving a disagreement or a dispute but internally amongst them or with an internal third party, that they then have they then call in an outside organization or agency that discriminates and negatively affects the rest of a family's life.
So how much insulation is there in the walls in these buildings so that you can't hear your neighbor?
And that is a question. Do you take into consideration seniors and, you know, young working class families, professionals, you know, people raising two kids? Are they going to be next to people who are 80 years old? Do they want that? These are all questions that the residents tried to deal with. And so I think there will be some deliberateness in terms of who lives where and who's able to live where. Of course, you do have Crescent Halls, which is across the street, which is mostly, you know, 60 years old and up in terms of the demographics there. And that's public housing, and that's also slated for redevelopment in a separate process. And so you do have, you know, kind of these kind of mixed worlds of a brewery, for instance, opening up across the street, which probably is not going to attract many 70-year-old people, you know, that are wheelchair-bound, right? But it is going to attract young 20-something, 30-something families of a certain economic standing in Charlottesville. And so, of course, all of these things are sending mixed messages of who does the community belong to. And one of the things that I think you hear from City Councilor Wes Bellamy and our Mayor Nakia Walker is that in doing this redevelopment process, that city officials and nonprofit staff have to be really intentional about making sure that the lower income families have a stake and have a priority in what the neighborhood ends up being because of this tumultuous history that we have here.
I want to make sure, just less than 10 minutes left in our conversation with Jordy Yeager today, the reimagining of Friendship Court, is to define Charlottesville's housing shortage, because that's really the key of what redoing Friendship Court is all about, and adding rooms or units to Friendship Court. I want to make sure to toss out there that February 7th, there is a Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission meeting, correct? Is that open to the public?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's February 7th at 7 p.m. People can go to that. You put that in the article, or I'm assuming that that's because you want people to go, or at least alert people who are interested so that they can go and learn more. So will you define, give us info on Charlottesville's housing shortage?
Sure. So essentially where we are as a city, and to a little bit lesser extent of as a region, but definitely that can't be understated, that those two are intertwined, the surrounding county and the city, is that there is a large demand for housing here at all income levels, and that the market, the number of units, apartments, houses that are available are responding to that with inflated cost. And so it's very expensive to live here. And that is okay for people who are earning enough money to be able to pay those rents, even if they're overpaying. You know, the federal guidelines say that a rent is affordable if you're paying 30% of your income. And so whether that's a mortgage or a rent or even in the home buying process, that's what's affordable. And so what we're seeing is that the vast majority of rentals in this area do not equate to 30% of people's
way
incomes.
They're way
above that. And our wages have not increased to that degree. So that the higher the income you make, the more okay you're going to be to kind of cushion that inflated housing cost. Yes, it'll be a pinch, but it won't be do I feed this child or do I put gas in the car sort of pinch. And so what I'm getting at is the lower the income that you have, the more tough it is to find housing that's affordable, and that all of the other expenses in life, from childcare to transportation to you know, putting food on the table, those are going to be affected by it. Our housing is kind of a trickle down effect of the upper incomes being satisfied, but the lower incomes having to bear the cost of that and bear the brunt of that burden.
There was an article in Seville Weekly for mapping inequality. How does that play into the Friendship Court? It seemed that they would be tied together.
Yeah, no, to a certain extent, it definitely all is tied together. So one of the things that I've been working on is a grant through the Charlottesville Area Community Foundation in partnership with the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center to map the historical use of different housing policies throughout Charlottesville. And one of the main ones that was used for the first half of the 20th century are covenants, are agreements in housing deeds that essentially say no one shall own or occupy this home other than people of Caucasian race. And this is inserted into the deeds of probably about three quarters of the single family housing stock that's created in the first half of the 20th century here. So we're talking, you know, Locust Grove, we're talking North Downtown, Fry Springs, Rugby Road, Meadowbrook Hills, all of the neighborhoods where you can imagine single family homes that are over 60 years old in Charlottesville. They have these racially restrictive clauses in their deeds, which discriminates against African Americans, obviously. But what that results in is the accumulation of wealth, because those are the same neighborhoods that are getting their streets paved. They're getting their water lines put in. They're getting their sewer lines put in. And remember, in the 60s...
All the things that you talked about that got the other ones...
deemed blighted and slummed and all of these, you know, it's not by coincidence that they ended up in this state. And so really what we're trying to do is visually represent how this came to be and then link that to the modern day disparities that we're seeing in terms of outcomes in life. You know, I think there's some quite excellent research that's been done over the last decade coming out of Raj Chetty and his team that have looked at where you live being the predictor of the outcome in life. So that if you live in neighborhood X, they can predict with certainty where you're going to end up in terms of your income level, in terms of your risk of incarceration, in terms of your education level, in terms of your health outcomes. All of these things are directly correlatory to where you live. Your environment is the number one predictor. And so if we can say that, then what is the reason that makes us live where we live? And it's not by accident. It's not by choice. It is by design and very deliberately carried out. And so if we're talking about how we want to shape our future as a city and what we want equity to look like in terms of access to resources, everybody should have equal access to resources, then we need to look at why that's not always the case and why that hasn't been the case in order to figure out what we might need to undo.
So the Reimagining a Friendship Court, 5 months plus, it's an impressive piece of work at SevilleTomorrow.org. What's next on the list?
I think I'm going to dive in full on into this mapping project. I've been working on it for the last probably 6 months as well. And this will really draw a lot of my attention. I'm working on a project with local photographer Eze Amos, working with some families who used to live in Vinegar Hill, about looking at what reclaiming that space might look like. And that's all I can say about it at this time. But that's an exciting project. I'm also working on a film project with Lorenzo Dickerson, a local filmmaker, and some other work over at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center.
Oh, nothing small, nothing tiny.
No, I've got a closet that needs finishing rebuilding, but that's about it.
That won't happen anytime soon either, will it? So just another second or so left here. I'm curious about the role. So really, you have like 15 seconds to answer this. What is the role of Nakia Walker in all of this?
I think she's advocating for residents that have long not been listened to or heard. And she's looking at what the future might look like in true equity, and not just equality, but equity of access, given the historical precedent that's been established, access to resources, access to opportunities.
Okay. Again, our guest today has been Jordy Yeager, local journalist. You can hear him everywhere from NPR, to WPVC. You can see his current work, The Reimagining of Friendship Court, on SeavilleTomorrow.org. Jordy, I hope you'll come back again 6 months, 8 months, 9 months from now and talk about your current project.
Definitely, and count on it.
Thanks so much. Everybody take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.